And I am going to try to go live and we'll see if it actually does anything.
Okay. And I am going to share my little presentation here. So this is the slide on the top is cut and paste from the beautiful copy of Stardust that was put out by Todd Supple. And this is the monthly meeting of May 13th, 2023. And I'm the current president, and somebody else wants to run for it. That'd be just fine by me, but don't imagine there's a whole lot of other folks wanting to do it. So welcome to any new NT attendees. So new folks can raise your hands. And I think that was, I forget.
Diana.
Yeah. I don't know if this raises my hand. It didn't, I'm not sure it worked. I don't know. Is it my turn?
Sure. How'd you hear about NCA?
Okay. I have heard about it when I lived in the DC area, and I always was intrigued by it and never really had the time to join. So now I am out here in Wyoming and
oh my goodness.
Remembered it and decided it would be really interesting. So a very brief background about myself. I did used to live in the DC area for about 20 years. I got my PhD in machine learning at the University of Maryland under Don Perlis in the computer science department. I worked first at Goddard as part of the COBE program doing displays of data. And then I worked at NIST in the automated factory with robotics. And then I went to the Naval Research Lab, where I started doing both AI and robotics. And I met my husband there. And we decided to leave the DC area and go to University of Wyoming, where we were professors for a while and then retired. And we're now here. And I'm still very interested in all aspects of science and excited to be part of this group. Now, unfortunately, Saturday nights are my evening with playing games with my grandsons. So I don't know how many of these meetings I'll be able to attend. I would love to attend as many as I can, but it's probably going to be rare, unfortunately. But I do go to DC twice a year and would like to participate as much as I can. That's it.
And you can watch the recent meetings on Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Or you can simply go to
the Facebook streaming doesn't always work, so they're not
okay.
On Facebook, but they're all of the recordings are on our website.
Okay, good enough.
Right. Okay. And on our website, you can join there. It's very easily. And as Elizabeth said, you can actually either listen to or view the recent meetings in their entirety because they're recorded. Any other new folks? Okay. So for next year, we have nominations open. So we need to take a few minutes on this. Most of the current officers have told me they're willing to continue. And the offices are listed down here, as you can see. And we have two trustees. One, Michael Chestnut's term is ending this year, and Jay was filling in for the position of Jack Gaffey, who passed away during this past year, and so that position will be open. So I'm willing to continue to be president, but if somebody else wants to do it, more power to you. John Hornstein is currently the vice president, willing to continue and doing a great job. Similarly with Jim Simpson, who's told me he cannot be here tonight, and he tells us we have about 10 or 11,000 in our treasury, and we've got about 100 members. And Jeffrey Norman is our assistant secretary treasurer and is willing to continue. Bernard Kaufman and Tom Crone have expressed interest in serving in the two trustee slots. So, does anybody have any other nominations for any of those positions? And I guess you could speak up or put a note into the chat. And
I don't have a suggestion for that, but I think we're going to need some more people to judge science fairs.
Yes.
That doesn't take very much time, but for a brief period, there is some work. And the people who do it currently are not getting younger.
Right. That will come around next spring, and we'll definitely have to make a push for that. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, March seems to be the month for it.
Right. And also, people can also mentor local folks if you can find a way to get in touch with them before they or while they're doing their project. But in any case, not hearing a whole lot of suggestions, I'll entertain a motion that we accept these nominations for president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, assistant secretary, treasurer, and trustee, as you see on the screen. Can I hear such a motion?
Yep.
Yeah, seconded.
So who's seconding now?
I did.
Okay, so that's John Hornstein. Maybe you shouldn't do the
okay. Second. Yeah. Okay.
But why do you need the why do you need a motion for that?
I don't know. I just thought that would be
Robert's rules of order.
Yeah. Doesn't the election have to be done in June?
Well, it will be done in June. This is not
so
the election.
There's nothing to do right
this
now.
This is just nominations. That's it.
So you just leave it as it is. It's been announced, and then people have time to get their names in if they want to volunteer or something. There's nothing else to do with it.
Okay. Fine by me. All right, so a couple of other things.
We'll have elections in June, so remind everyone to show up because we do need people to vote in June.
Right. And on a different topic, my daughter's doing some design work for NCA swag. She's made a 2x2 poster, and that's going to be sent to Jay Miller. And that attaches more easily to tables, like ordinary card tables, than the 2x4 foot thing. But I think it'd be really nice for individual members to be able to order an NCA hat or an NCA t-shirt or whatever, and that we could also give to our speakers, like Dr. Louis of tonight, something like a hat or a t-shirt or whatever with our NCA logo on it. And these days, it's really, really cool and simple because you don't have to have one of the members keeping a large box or two of swag. It can be done directly. If anybody has experience with that and has done that sort of thing or is a good designer or anything like that, please let me know.
Our speakers do get a 1-year free subscription to Sky and Telescope.
That is correct. As I say, right now we give them a subscription to Stardust, which isn't much considering
but
what
also
we get from them.
But also Sky and Telescope, which is very nice.
Well, That's nicer. Okay. And we've got at least four donated telescopes to auction off. One was a 8-inch homemade Dobsonian that has been refurbished. Was made by a woman amateur astronomer in Chicago, and four and an 8-inch Celestron Nexstar and a 5-inch Mead. And I'll give you details on that later. And Jim Simpson had a very interesting idea that perhaps as a club, we could purchase time on a remote robotic telescope observatory. And it would be really cool if we could have a live view of some far south deep sky object, for example, you know, like the Tarantula Nebula. That'd be really cool. I'm not sure it's possible. I've done some research. There are a bunch of networks like SLU, iTelescope, and Mark Slade Remote Observatory, but you know, details need to be investigated. And we're changing the hours for the telescope making modification maintenance workshop. It's going to go from 6 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays and Fridays. Let's see. Yeah, so concerning exploring the sky, and I'm sure Jay is going to have to be telling something about it. We had our first such event on April 15th, and for a new feature, we had a planetarium show at the little planetarium that's at the Rock Creek Park Nature Center. And that was full to capacity. It's not a very big planetarium, but it was full and people were very interested. And we were lucky because the sky mostly cleared up for about an hour. And it was very interesting to see Jay Miller's brand new EV Scope 2, which I'd heard of, but not ever looked through or looked at before. Not cheap, but it is kind of an interesting feature. Jay, did you want to add anything?
It is expensive. They have cheaper ones. This one does have an eyepiece. It's interesting that if somebody has the app, either on an iPhone or an Android, and they're within about 50 feet, they can see whatever we're looking at through the telescope. And it works, the way it works is it builds up the image, so you see very faint stuff that ordinarily you would not be able to see through a 4.5-inch telescope. I mean, we were looking at the one of the galaxies, the Pinwheel Galaxy, which ordinarily you wouldn't be able to see. And you could actually see the arms of the galaxy. So it is very interesting. Yeah. And the reason, and there are other scopes that on the market that do somewhat the same thing. And you can do that with something called a Revolution Imager, which you can use on any other telescope. One of the things about the EV scope, it was developed along with SETI, or at least some people with SETI, and it has some citizen science parts to it. So you can do things like exoplanets. So if you get, let's say, a couple of hours worth of an exoplanet, somebody else someplace on this planet can do the other 2 hours of it, and you get the whole curve. So it's a very interesting instrument.
Thank you. And the next one is May 20th, which is obviously a week from today. And it starts at 9, at least
9 o'clock.
Outdoor part is 9 o'clock. The indoor part at the planetarium starts at 8.
You know, one other thing that I wanted to bring up, the guy who does the human interest column in the Washington Post, I keep forgetting his name.
John, the new guy or the old guy?
No, the one presently, John.
Yeah, that's Jeff Chester.
No. This is the human interest column that's been in the Post for several years, a number of years. Something. I keep forgetting his name. But anyway, I was thinking of maybe contacting him to see if he would be interested in maybe devoting one of his columns to exploring the sky, since this is our 75th year. What it also might mean is we might get several hundred people coming out to and exploring the sky.
Yeah. That's an idea. Oh, regarding stuff in the Washington Post, I didn't mention this in, and I shall. The there was something called Skywatch, which was written by Blaine Friedlander every month for like 30 years, roughly, and he retired from that. And Jeff Chester, who used to be a member of NCA and at one point was one of the officers, and he's a current member of NOVAC, one of our sister clubs, and he's also a longtime information person at the Naval Observatory. Well, he's taken that over, and he's hasn't yet gotten permission to put in local events such as Exploring the Sky or other clubs' activities, but that may happen.
I sent him the Exploring the Sky flyer, along with the guy who runs the one of the weather columns.
Good, thank you. And that's all I have.
By the way, I noticed that the Skywatch column is now in the Tuesday Health and Science section.
Right. They're still playing around with that. They have not figured out where they're going to have it yet. They're still experimenting, they told me.
Jeff Chester was our president.
And by the way, I think that the guy Jay was talking about is John Kelly.
Yeah, that's it, John Kelly. Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Okay, that's all I have. Does anybody else have any other announcements of any sort?
Well, just wanted to add to your announcement that Jeff Chester was our president.
Yeah.
In 1984 and 85.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, John.
Okay.
Can you introduce our speaker?
I surely can. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Dana Louie, our speaker this evening. She has a master's degree in aerospace engineering, as well as a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. And she served as an officer in the U.S. Air Force, working as both a flight test engineer and as a foreign air officer in Japan. That's really a very diverse background. And Dr. Louie has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Maryland and is now a postdoc in the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. She uses data from both ground-based and space-based telescopes on the light that reaches us from a distant star while a planet orbiting that star is passing between us and the star. The light from the star then reaches us only after having passed through part of the planet's atmosphere. So the spectrum of that light bears the imprint of that part of the planet's atmosphere. These so-called transit events can lead both to the discovery of previously unknown exoplanets, but it also provides data on the atmospheres of both previously known and previously unknown exoplanets. Dana has used data from the TESS instrument. TESS is the acronym for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and also data from the James Webb Space Telescope and from the Hubble Space Telescope. Some of the exoplanets she studied are quite exotic. An ultra-hot Jupiter orbiting an unusually hot host star, a hot mini-Neptune, In contrast, our Neptune is far from its star, the sun, and is cold. So it will be very interesting to hear what she has to say. Dr. Louis.
Yeah, thanks, John. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here tonight to talk with you all. And thanks for welcoming me to your group. Sounds like a great group. And so I'm going to share my screen right now. Hopefully this will work.
Yep.
And then I need to go to presenter view. And now I think you can see.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's difficult for me to see you all now because I have my slides in front of me. but it's I can see John. That's it right now. So, and as we go along, I'm going to talk about exploring exoplanets with the James Webb Space Telescope. And I'm trying to explain some background as I go along as well. But if I don't explain anything well, feel free to break in with any questions and ask me as we go along. And if you ask me something that could turn into a longer conversation, I may ask you to hold the question until the end, but feel free to break in anytime. And so let's get started. So on this slide, I have a couple of overarching questions that scientists are studying with the James Webb Space Telescope. First, how do exoplanets form and evolve? And for example, on the left of the slide, we see a young star with its protoplanetary disk of gas and dust. And these disks contain the minerals that are used to form planets. With JWST, we can examine these disks with direct imaging. I'm not going to talk about direct imaging this evening, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit about that. And you'll see some news press releases about that. There was just one that came out a couple of days ago, in fact. But another thing we can do is we can explore what exoplanets and their atmospheres are made of. And on the right, I show a cross-section of an exoplanet atmosphere. And just to add, oops, there. And so on the left, I show direct imaging of a disk. On the right, transiting exoplanets, you know, we can look into atmospheres. So with JWST, we're studying transiting exoplanets to discover more about the planet's atmospheres. And in particular, Webb's infrared capabilities can help us understand what molecules can be found in those atmospheres. And so, as I alluded to tonight, my focus is going to be on discussing transiting exoplanets. And JWST has had so many discoveries this year that there are a lot of things to discuss. So I'd like to begin by providing some background on the exoplanets that we've discovered to date. On the left, I show the number of exoplanets we've discovered over time. This is a cumulative number of planets discovered. So you can see the years along the bottom and then the total number of planets per year. And many of the recent discoveries were found using the transit technique, which is in green on this plot. Space-based exoplanet discovery surveys like Kepler, which you've probably heard about, and TESS, which John just explained a minute ago, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, brought us many of these recent discoveries. So Kepler's mission began in 2009, and then TESS began a bit later in 2018. And now on the right side of this plot, I show general exoplanet demographics. So we found over 5,000 exoplanets to date. And many of our early discoveries were of gas giant planets. So those make up about 30% of the total that we know about. Super Earths or sub-Neptunes are planets that have sizes between Earth and Neptune. And those planets don't exist in our solar system. And they also comprise about 30% of what we know about. And then we found a few terrestrial planets, but these comprise a mere 4% of the total. And so tonight I've tried to pick planets from different size regimes and talk about atmospheric characterization that we've done with those planets with JWST. So discovery techniques like the transit technique are most sensitive to planets that orbit close to their host star. At the plot on the left, I show the radius of the transiting exoplanets on the y-axis versus the orbital period on the x-axis. And the solar system planets are overlaid as well for reference. Now, many of these transiting exoplanets, as you can see, lie on orbits interior to Earth's. And because of that, a lot of them have hot atmospheric temperatures as well. And we'll, you'll see some of that with the examples that I show you. Next, I wanted to show a video that demonstrates the transit technique. And John sort of explained it, how the transit happens whenever a planet passes in front of its host star as viewed from the Earth. And when we observe an exoplanet transit, we measure the amount of light that we observe from the host star over time. And that gives us a transit light curve. And you'll see that when I show you the video. So the light decreases, obviously, as the planet passes in front of the star. If we observe at different wavelengths, as I'll show you in the video, then the transit depth varies due to the composition of the atmosphere, if the planet has an atmosphere. And that's because different molecules or aerosols can make the planet appear bigger or smaller at particular wavelengths. It may appear bigger if molecules in the atmosphere are absorbing. And that variation in transit depth with wavelength is the basis for transmission spectroscopy. And I'll describe a bit more about that as we go along. But here's the video I wanted to show you, the transit technique. So you can see how the flux in different wavelengths decreases over time. And that's a transit light curve. And next, before discussing JWST's first results regarding transiting exoplanets, I'm going to talk about the telescope itself. In particular, I wanted to compare JWST to Hubble and Spitzer, which were also used to characterize the atmospheres of exoplanets. And during the presentation, I have a few plots that show previous Hubble and Spitzer results compared to our more recent JWST results. So here I'm comparing the sizes of the telescope as well as their mirror apertures. And JWST's larger mirror of 6.5 meter aperture means that it's going, as you all well know, it's going to collect a lot more photons of light from the targets that we observe. So Hubble's mirror in comparison has a 2.4 meter aperture, and Spitzer's had a 0.85 meter aperture. And in addition, JWST is located at L2, and so we're able to observe those exoplanet transits continually. We don't have to deal with gaps in our observations like we had with Hubble due to its orbit around the Earth. And I have a plot that shows you what a Hubble transit curve looks like. And so this is actually different visits observing the same planet. And so the plots are offset. But if you look at one of these transit light curves, then the black points are the data and the colored line is a fit to the data. And so you can see there are gaps between the black points. And that's when you can't see the planet transit because the Earth is blocking the view as Hubble orbits the Earth. And so here we compare the spectral coverage of JWST to HST and Spitzer. And actually, I should ask, can you see my cursor? Because I'm okay. I just wanted to make sure. So I can see John shaking his head. So I'm comparing the spectral coverage of the various telescopes. So as I mentioned, HST and Spitzer were those two previous missions that we used to characterize atmospheres. So Hubble observed in the UV, in the optical, and then a little bit into the near infrared. And James Webb observes in the red optical, then into the near infrared and the mid infrared. And Spitzer observed even further out into the infrared. But for Spitzer, many of our exoplanet observations were only for broadband points at 3.5 and 4.5 microns. And I do have a video that I'll show you on that, comparing some Spitzer results to the new JWST results. Some of the HST observations were also taken in the near infrared with the wide field camera 3 instrument. But some of the observations with Hubble that are actually complementary to JWST are observations taken in the UV and optical. And so JWST has 4 different science instruments. And this diagram shows the wavelengths of the instruments as well as their modes for imaging at the top and spectroscopy down at the bottom. And then the wavelengths are listed along the very bottom of the slide on a logarithmic scale. So the NIRCam instrument is shown in green, NIRSpec is shown in magenta, and then the NIRIS instrument is shown in blue. And these all observe in the near infrared up to about 5 microns. And then the MIRI instrument, the mid-infrared instrument shown in orange, is the instrument, the only one on JWST that can observe up to about 28 microns. With transmission spectroscopy, we use primarily the spectroscopic modes at the bottom. There are also some JWST Cycle 1 observations that have made use of MIRI's broadband filters, and I'll describe one of those programs later. And this is a plot I showed previously, and this shows a cross-section of a typical planetary atmosphere and typical atmospheric constituents that are detectable at different wavelengths. And just as a reminder, JWST is sensitive to these infrared, to these molecules in its infrared wavelengths. And so some of the first observations and the first science results for transiting exoplanets came from the Transiting Exoplanet Community Early Release Science Program. So I'm going to start by discussing key results from that. And first to start off, though, these are the JWST ERS program goals. So from the beginning, the Early Release Science Program was designed to help the transiting exoplanet community as a whole as we move forward with JWST observations. And there were actually hundreds of people on the team for the ERS program. The goals of this program are listed on the slide. They wanted to substantially advance the transiting exoplanet community's technical and scientific knowledge before JWST cycle 2, or before year 2 of observations. And they had some strategic objectives. They wanted to exercise the highest priority time series modes of all 4 of JWST's instruments. They wanted to observe transits when the planet passes in front of its host star, eclipses when it passes behind, and phase curves. And I have a diagram that will show you what I mean by all of those terms. And then develop remediation strategies for any instrument-specific systematic noise, and provide a comprehensive suite of transiting exoplanet data to demonstrate JWST's scientific capabilities. So on this slide, I wanted to introduce the 3 observing components of the Transiting Exoplanet ERS Early Release Science Program. And after describing these 3 components, then I'll move on to highlight some of the results. And so the first component was the panchromatic transmission program. And so this is to observe the planet as it transits in front of the host star. So as John mentioned earlier, when an exoplanet transits in front of the host star, we see radiation from the star that's transmitted through the planet's atmosphere, and we can detect molecules that may be in the atmosphere if they block some of that light. Then the second phase is the MIRI phase curve program. And during a phase curve, we observe the planet as it passes through its orbital phases. So typically we observe an entire orbit of the planet. And then the last program is observing a secondary eclipse or a planet's thermal emission. And you see that thermal emission from the planet disappear and then reappear. We observe the planet and star, the combined light from the planet and star before the planet passes behind its star. Then when the planet is behind the star, we see only the flux from the star. And then again, we observe when the planet comes out from behind its star. And also I should point out on the slides that these are the various instruments used in the program. And I'm going to focus on the panchromatic transmission program, which observed with NIRASOS, NIRSpec, G395H, and NIRCam. And so that was all in the near infrared. And so I'm going to highlight some of the results from panchromatic transmission on the next few slides. So first of all, WASP-39b was the target for the panchromatic transmission program. And this is the host star is slightly cooler and smaller than our sun. It has a J magnitude of 10.8. And the planet itself is a Saturn mass planet but the radius is bigger than Jupiter. So it's a very low density planet. It has a very high scale height for the atmosphere. And past observations with other observatories have shown that I'm going to show you what we found in previous observations pretty soon. I'll just move on and show you the next the previous results. Okay, so before JWST, this is the best composite transmission spectrum that we had of WASP-39b. And here, the transit depth is on the y-axis, and wavelength is on a logarithmic scale on the x-axis. So the higher values of the transit depth mean that more light is blocked at a given wavelength. So for example, molecules in the atmosphere may be blocking light at that wavelength. We had Hubble's Wide Field Camera 3 WFC3 data covering the near IR up to about 1.7 microns. And from that, we could infer the detection of water. So you can see, for example, right here around 1.4 microns, you can infer the detection of water. At wavelengths longer than 1.7 microns, we had only two Spitzer broadband points. And the best fit model for this spectrum included carbon dioxide. And you can see CO2 on the slide here for the best fit model. But the detection was not robust at all. And so I'll come back to this later after showing the JWST results. And so the ERS transit team's first results came from this panchromatic transmission program. And here I show the transit light curve on the left in the transmission spectrum showing the detection of carbon dioxide on the right. And I'm going to discuss both of these on the next couple of slides in more detail. So this first plot shows the transit light curve, and it shows the relative brightness of the host star versus time. So this plot depicts the transit light curves at different wavelengths, and those are depicted by different colors and also different symbols. And you can see that the transit appears deeper in the green color, which is also depicted by squares. The greater depth at that wavelength indicates that more of the light's blocked by the atmosphere. And in this case, that's due to carbon dioxide. Now, when we produce the transmission spectrum for JWST, we look at more than just the three wavelengths of light that are shown here. We take spectra of the host star over time, and we call those time series observations. And then we bend the spectra across a certain number of wavelengths. From that, we can produce transit light curves for many wavelengths, depending on how much we bend our spectra. And from the depth of the transit light curves, we can produce the transmission spectrum. So in the next slide, I have a video that shows a synopsis of that process that we use to produce a transmission spectrum from time series observations. So this is a video explaining how we go from those time series observations to the transmission spectrum. And as I've been talking about, we observe the exoplanet host star over time. As the planet passes in front of its star, we detect a decrease in the amount of flux. And then that decrease in flux is proportional to the square of the radius of the planet divided by the square of the radius of the star. Okay, and then that decrease varies with wavelength depending on the species that are in the planet's atmosphere and which ones are absorbing light. And so you can see we can bin our spectra, measure the transit depth at different wavelengths, and then produce the transmission spectrum. And so a transmission spectrum is basically a plot of the variation in transit depth with the wavelength. And this is the transmission spectrum released by the ERS team in August of 2022. And so the amount of light blocked on the y-axis is basically the same as the transit depth. And so the atmosphere is absorbing more light where we have molecules in the atmosphere. And here we have the carbon dioxide. And so the results, this first release showed that we had the first definitive detection of carbon dioxide on an exoplanet. And also, this was the first detailed transmission spectrum from 3 to 5.5 microns. And now I said I was going to compare this to Spitzer, and this is a video that the ERS transit team produced that shows that. And we have the two Spitzer broad points, broadband points depicted here. And as I mentioned when I showed you the previous results, the presence of carbon dioxide was inferred from those two broadband points, but JWST near spec data allow us to resolve the shape of the carbon dioxide spectral features. And I'm going to play the video now. And I think it's really cool how detailed the data are with JWST compared to Spitzer. Okay, then the ERS team announced additional results from the panchromatic transmission program on the 22nd of November, and these were for all four instruments and modes used in the program. This slide shows all four independent spectra acquired using the four different instrument modes, and I'm going to discuss just a few of the additional key results from their analysis on the next couple of slides. So this spectrum shows or this plot shows the spectrum for nearest SOS, and that ranges from wavelengths between 0.63 and 2.8 microns. Distinctive features that you can see on the plot include potassium between 0.72 and 0.82 microns, and that's shown with the gray vertical bar. Then there are three different water features, and those are depicted with the light blue, and there's carbon monoxide, which is shown in red. The NEARIST team did an extensive analysis of the potassium feature, and I'll show that on the next plot. So this plot demonstrates evidence for a supersolar potassium to oxygen ratio in WASP-39b's atmosphere. The team ran various models of different K to O ratios, and they held other parameters in their models constant, and then they fit for those K to O values. And they found that the best fit to their data was for a K to O ratio of 0.4. Now, this is the full transmission spectrum for near spec PRISM, which spans wavelengths between 0.5 to 5.5 microns. And we already discussed the carbon dioxide feature, but next I'd like to discuss another feature detected, which was sulfur dioxide. And so another paper released by the ERS transit team was by Tsai et al. And they used a suite of photochemical models to show that the absorption feature at 4.05 microns was due to SO2. And I guess one thing I didn't mention in this before is before the team knew that this was sulfur dioxide, they detected this small bump in their spectrum. And then theorists started to model it, and they found that the model that best explained that feature was this SO2 feature. And this plot shows that the model with 10 times solar metallicity is the one that best fits the data. And so the team had a press release and noted that this was the first direct evidence of photochemistry in the atmosphere of an exoplanet. And this slide shows how the photochemistry in this exoplanet works. And this is a process that's described in that paper by Tsai et al. So this presents the basic theory. It starts with photodissociation of water, and then the hydroxide and hydrogen molecules interact with hydrogen sulfide through a series of steps to produce sulfur dioxide, which was identified in the atmosphere. And so I just wanted to present the key results from that ERS panchromatic transmission program. First of all, JWST has a large wavelength range at relatively high spectral resolution. There's good agreement between the four instrument modes. And I should point out too that the team is still working on a paper to combine the results from all four of the instruments. They released separate papers for each instrument before, but they were in good agreement. With SO2, they had the first detection of photochemistry in an exoplanet atmosphere. They had the first clear detection of CO2 in an exoplanet atmosphere. And then the presence of sodium, potassium, and water features confirmed previous space and ground-based detections, and the longer wavelength water features had not been previously seen. And now I'd like to move on to discuss results that came from cycle one of JWST's General Observer Program, which is actually still ongoing. And there are actually still results that haven't been released yet from people that are still analyzing data. And so here, I depict some of the properties of the transiting exoplanet targets that will be or have been observed in JWST cycle one. And on the plot, I show the planet equilibrium temperature on the y-axis. So you can see that many of these planets are hotter than our solar system planets. And as I showed you at the beginning, there are many exoplanets that orbit close to their host stars. So they're relatively hot. Planet size is on the x-axis. So you can see that several planets are close to the Earth's radius and size, but then there are several that are larger as well. And there are many that are close to Jupiter's radius and size. Oops, I didn't mean to go forward. Oops, let me go back. And so in general, the planets span a variety of sizes and radii. And also, many of the planets were discovered by the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. So TESS has been doing a good job at finding planets that are relatively bright and orbit small host stars, which produce a large transit signal because the host star is relatively small. Also on this plot, I'd like to point out the symbols represent different types of observations. So transits are in the circles, and again, that's when the planets pass in front of their host star. Eclipses are in the orange squares when the planet passes behind the host star, and then phase curves are in the triangles, and that's when we observe a full orbit of the planet. And now I wanted to discuss just a few of the key results that are out so far from the first year of JWST observations. And first of all, I wanted to start off with this paper, which was just released earlier this week, and this is for GJ1214b, which is a sub-Neptune-sized planet with a size about 2.6 times the radius of Earth. And these are results from MIRI's low-resolution spectrograph phase curve for the planet. And like I said, they were just released this week. So the planet orbits a small late M-dwarf host star, which has a temperature of just over 3000 Kelvin, and it's only 0.2 times the sun's radius. The planet orbits the star in around 38 hours, and the system's relatively close, 48 light years away, and has a fairly high J magnitude, 9.75. So I added this diagram just to show you the phase curve and how we expect the flux, the combined flux from the planet and star to vary throughout the observations. So in this case, the team used the JWST mid-infrared instrument low resolution spectrograph in slitless mode, and that spans a wavelength from 5 to 12 microns. And they observed the orbit just before it went into secondary eclipse. So they observed one eclipse, then an entire orbit. They observed a transit, and then they went around again, and they observed a second secondary eclipse. And that's typical a lot of times for phase curve observations. And also, I'd like to point out that this is the first time I'm describing MIRI observations. The previous observations were with the near-infrared instrument up to around 5 microns, whereas now we're going out to 12 microns. And before describing the new results, I wanted to present those previous observations. So GJ1214b was observed extensively with both ground and space-based observations, like Hubble for space-based. And the previous results basically had a relatively flat spectrum. And by doing modeling, the team ruled out clear hydrogen helium atmospheres on the planet, but they couldn't distinguish between two different possible scenarios that this planet could have for its atmosphere. And one of those was a cloudy hydrogen helium atmosphere. So clouds could have been blocking some of the signal, or a metal-rich atmosphere. And just to show you in transmission spectroscopy, which were the previous observations, this diagram that I have now shows you a cloudy atmosphere on the top versus a clear atmosphere on the bottom. And so if you have a cloudy atmosphere, even if it's hydrogen and helium, where you expect to see a lot of spectral features, if you have a cloudy atmosphere, it's going to disrupt the passage of starlight through the atmosphere. And as a result, you'll have little variation in the intensity of starlight with wavelength. But on the bottom, if you have a clear atmosphere with no clouds, that allows the starlight to penetrate deeper into the atmosphere, where molecules like water can absorb the light. And then as a result, you have a transmission spectrum with absorption features as depicted here. And so moving on to the results from the phase curve, this figure shows some of the most important results. So on this plot, there are three different panels. And on each of the panels, the black line with the gray behind it, that is the model that shows the phase curve for the planet during these observations. So this is the planet to star flux ratio. So this is a phase curve model for the planet on each of the three curves. And then the team ran various global climate models, GCMs. And on panel A at the top, they ran those climate models for clear atmospheres, but at different metallicities. And all of those models predicted higher temperatures and thus more emission from the phase curve than what was observed. In panel B, they looked at a 100 times solar metallicity atmosphere with various thick hazes. And for example, they found that absorptive hazes like the soot, which is in the darker color, they heat the day side and then cool the night side. So it doesn't provide a good fit to the phase curve that was observed. They found that more reflective hazes, like this light orange color, which is here, is a better fit to the phase curve that was observed. And in the end, they ran another max reflective haze, but they varied the metallicity. And they found that the best model that matched their observations were some of these higher metallicity models, either the blue or the purple, which are shown here, were a closer match to what they observed. And so the team, as an overall conclusion, said that this comparison between the phase curve data and their three-dimensional models of the planet revealed that the planet has a high metallicity composition, but it's blanketed by a thick, highly reflective layer of clouds or haze. And next, I'd like to move on to another result, and that's for TRAPPIST-1b. And you may have heard of the TRAPPIST-1 system, which is a system of seven planets observing a small M dwarf star. And on the upper right of the slide, I show the range of radii for the planets and the masses. So they range between 0.75 to 1.1 times Earth radius, and then between 0.3 to 1.4 times the mass of the Earth. And also, as far as the size of the system, this is our solar system, but the TRAPPIST-1 system is enlarged 25 times, and all seven planets would actually fit inside the orbit of Mercury if they were in our system. And so in just a minute, I'm going to describe the results of secondary eclipse observations for TRAPPIST-1b, which is the innermost planet. But I wanted to just show you a comparison of the host star. And some of you may know this already. I know you're all astronomers, but I wanted to bring it up anyway. So the TRAPPIST-1 host star is roughly 1/10 the radius of our sun. And so because of that, the transit depth, as I mentioned before, the transit depth in the light curve is proportional to the cross-sectional area of the planet divided by the cross-sectional area of the star. And so because of that, a given size planet passing in front of this host star, TRAPPIST-1, would produce a transit depth that's about 100 times greater than the transit depth of the same planet passing in front of our sun. And so for this reason, the TRAPPIST-1 system has garnered a lot of attention, and all seven planets are going to be observed during this first year of JWST observations. In fact, I've heard of other observations that are ongoing, but the teams are analyzing the data and they haven't released the results yet. So that's exciting to look forward to. So today I'm focusing on recent results from secondary eclipse observations of TRAPPIST-1b. And so this figure just serves as a reminder of what we measure during secondary eclipse. So in this time, they observed in a broadband filter, the MIRI's broadband filter at about 15 microns. And so just before and just after secondary eclipse, we measure the combined light from the planet and the star. And then during the eclipse, we measure the star light only. And then from that, they can determine the temperature, the dayside temperature of TRAPPIST-1b. And so this plot shows a comparison of the dayside temperature of TRAPPIST-1b as measured using MIRI. And it compares it, this is the measured value, and it compares it to computer models showing what the temperature would be under various conditions. So the measured dayside temperature of TRAPPIST-1b at 15 microns corresponds to a temperature of about 500 Kelvin. And that's consistent with the model shown here that assumes the planet's tidally locked, has a dark colored surface, no atmosphere, and no redistribution of heat from dayside to nightside. Now, in comparison, if the heat energy from the star were distributed evenly around the planet, for example, due to an atmosphere, the temperature at 15 microns would be lower at 400 Kelvin. And as a comparison on this plot, they also put the dayside temperature of Mercury. And so TRAPPIST-1's cooler than the dayside of Mercury, which consists of bare rock and no significant atmosphere. But they also point out that Mercury receives about 1.6 times more energy from the sun than TRAPPIST-1b does from its star. And so additional observations are forthcoming, and that can help with interpretations of the data. And this is the innermost planet to the TRAPPIST-1 system. So it's exciting to look forward to what we'll find from the other planets in the system. And some of those are in the habitable zone of TRAPPIST-1. Also, the team pointed out this was the first detection of thermal emission from an exoplanet as small and cool as those in the solar system. So that's exciting as well.
So Vanna,
yeah.
Do all of the TRAPPIST planets transit, or just a couple of them, or?
Oh, they do all transit.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, they have to be careful. Like I've seen some papers that showed transits happening at the same time, you know, so they have to be careful in planning their observations as well.
Wow.
You know, to make sure. Yeah.
I guess if the planets are all close in like that lineup works, but wow.
Right. And I don't remember the exact orbital periods of all the planets, but transits happen quite often, which is good. I mean, for that paper that I just talked about, there were 5 different observations of the planet, of the secondary eclipse for the planet. So they measured that temperature by looking at all 5 of those.
Cool.
Yeah. And I know that there are teams doing the same with transits of other planets in the TRAPPIST system. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Okay, and so next I wanted to move on to observations of another planet, and this planet's also orbiting an M dwarf host star, and this time it's a warm super Earth planet, GJ486b. And so, let's see, like both the last two planets that I discussed, this planet also orbits a small cool host star. And as I mentioned with the TRAPPIST planets, when the planets orbit small, cool host stars, they produce larger signals or deeper transit depth in transmission spectroscopy observations. And so for that reason, astronomers are focusing our search for Earth-like atmospheres on planets that are orbiting those small, cool host stars. However, one open question deals with whether those planets can actually maintain an atmosphere. M-dwarfs also have highly variable extreme UV radiation environments, And so, so it's uncertain whether those atmospheres can persist. So this program that I'm going to be talking about with GJ486B is part of a Cycle 1 program to help answer that question. And so this is the overall result that I was going to discuss. This is the transmission spectrum that the team produced for GJ486B. And by comparing their measured transmission spectrum to various models, oh, and I can blow this up to bigger size. So by comparing their data points, the white data points, with different models, astronomers have detected water vapor in their observations, but there's uncertainty as to whether the water vapor is from cool star spots in the host star, and that's shown in the orange, or a water-rich atmosphere model. Oh, I keep pressing that by accident. And one thing the team points out, though, is that the data points are here, and the two models diverge at shorter wavelengths, especially below about 0.8 microns. And so observations at those wavelengths could help determine which model better explains the data. And the team also made a point of saying that MIRI low-resolution spectrograph data observations are currently planned, and so that can help them to further constrain their models. So I think more information is to come from this. But I thought this was interesting because it helps to look at that question of whether planets orbiting M dwarfs can maintain their atmospheres. And these are the final results that I wanted to discuss this evening. And these are for a near-spec phase curve observations of an ultra-hot Jupiter, WASP-121b. And these actually came out earlier this year. So this planet has an equilibrium temperature of about 2400 degrees Kelvin. It's very, very hot. And it orbits a hotter F-type host star, hotter than the other stars that I've been discussing. And this orbits its host star in just over 30 hours. So the near-spec G395H collects photons on two different detectors called NRS1 and NRS2, and the astronomers analyze the broadband phase curves for each of those detectors separately. And I'll show you that on the next few slides. And here, this is just a reminder of the phase curve. And again, they observed two eclipses. So they started before the first eclipse, observed an entire orbit, and then observed for the second eclipse as well. And so this shows some of their results. And in this plot, this shows the planet to star emission for both the day side and the night side of the planet. And the data for the broadband points in the NRS1 and the NRS2 detectors are shown by the black diamonds. And they note that their error bars are smaller than the black diamonds. So that is their result. And then they also overplot on this 3D global climate models for clear atmospheres at both 1x and 5x solar heavy metal richments. And they also bin the model data. So those are shown by the color points. For both the day side and the night side, the team pointed out that they saw larger emission from NRS2 at the longer wavelengths than NRS1. So in other words, the black points, the data points for the longer wavelengths are higher. They show more emission than the data points for the shorter wavelengths. And the team pointed out that their analysis showed that the radius of the planet over the radius of the star is greater for NRS2 as well. And they said that could be due to wavelength-dependent opacity sources within the atmosphere. Also, they paid particular attention to the night side emissions, and this was one of the key results that they came out with. And the team found that the measured night side brightness temperatures are much lower than the clear atmosphere global climate model predictions. So in other words, the emissions less for the data points than it is for the models, and also the brightness temperature that they derived is much lower. And they said the temperature of the atmosphere, I mean, it was less than 1,000 for the lower wavelengths, and it was less than 1,200 for the longer wavelengths. And the team postulated that because of that, silicate clouds can condense, and that may block emission from the lower, hotter layers of the atmosphere, and that would lower the brightness temperature. So this was in an APJ letter, and the team said these were preliminary results. They want to examine the data further, but these are the results thus far. The exoplanet, this was an exoplanet JWST near-spec phase curve measurement. It showed a great amount of stability. And they said that cloud formation produced a lower nightside brightness temperature for this planet. Now I wanted to move on. I haven't talked about any of my work with JWST, and that's because it hasn't been published yet, but I wanted to just talk briefly about what I've been doing this year. And first of all, I'm part of a JWST guaranteed time observations program for the hot Jupiter WASP-17b and also for the warm Neptune HAPP-26b. And in particular, I'm looking at NIRAS SOS data analysis, and I just put a diagram of the subarray where we collect the data. So we have curved spectral traces for NIRAS SOS spectroscopic data, and it spans wavelengths between 0.6 for the second order spectrum up to about 2.8 microns. So it's in the near infrared. And we have data in hand for WASP-17b. I've been working hard with the other members of our team to analyze the data, and there are other instruments that are observing this planet as well. And we're not sure when we're going to publish, but we just got the data in March. And so we're still analyzing it, and we have it. It's not going to be public for a year, so we're going to take our time analyzing it and having the modelers look at it and try to infer what's happening in the atmosphere. And we should also have data for HAT-P26 by the end of June or early July. And then I'm also part of a program to observe the hot Jupiter HD189733b, and I'm doing that. The PI for the program is my dissertation advisor, Drake Deming. And so my role in this program will be to look at the Miriam medium resolution data, which Drake is also looking at. And we should have all the data in hand by early June. So that's coming up soon. And let's see. Another thing I wanted to bring up is that JWST Cycle 2 General Observer Program was just released this past week on Wednesday. So that's serendipitous. And so I have a couple of plots just to show in broad terms what we can expect from JWST Cycle 2. So these are some plots that compare transit observations only from Cycle 1 to those for Cycle 2. So on the left slide, or the left plot on the slide, we have both Cycle 1 and Cycle 2 transiting exoplanets depicted with the planet radius on the y-axis and then the incident flux and Earth fluxes on the x-axis. The Cycle 2 observations have diamonds around them. So you can see, as I've pointed out before, and the stellar temperature is shown in the color. So as I've pointed out before, a lot of these small planets are being observed orbiting these small, cool host stars. And then we also have in Cycle 2 several big planets close to Jupiter's radius or above being observed. And those are at a variety of host star effective temperatures. So that's really interesting. And then a smattering of planets between Earth and Jupiter sizes. And the plot on the right's very similar, except it has planet radius versus equilibrium temperature, and equilibrium temperature will also be hotter with the incident flux. But this also shows, if you have a question, go ahead.
What do you mean by incident flux?
Oh, I mean,
onto the planet from its
right
star?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. So, and it's measured in Earth's. So like flux is what we got at Earth. And if it's, so some of these are very hot.
Thanks.
Yep, no problem. And so the difference on this plot on the right is it doesn't show the host star temperature, but it just shows JWST GTO transits, and it has some Spitzer points. But overall, it looks like for the small planets, we're still going to be observing the smaller host stars. And and then various stellar effective temperatures for the bigger planets. And this is just a summary of highlights from what I talked about this evening. And I'll leave that summary up there, and I can take further questions. And if you would like me to go back to any slide, I'd be happy to do that as well, if you have any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Louis, for a great talk.
Thank you.
This is very interesting.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions? Don't see any. Well,
there's a lot of detail there. It was a lot of detail and kind of hard to absorb and everything.
So. Yeah, it is. Well, you know, people can contact me in the future if they have questions that come up too. Like if the video is successful and and it's posted.
I have one little question. If you go back a couple of slides, it was probably just something about the, right there.
Oh, yeah.
So what are CH1 and CH2 and all that
stuff? Oh, it's just channels, different channels. It's the way MIRI MRS observes. What I actually wanted to depict on here, and I should have mentioned this, is that the medium resolution spectrograph observes between 5 and 28 microns. It's so it covers wavelength regime that that other instruments don't cover. So it's a medium resolution spectrograph, and
okay, so the longer wavelengths are less efficiently detected.
They are. That's right. Less photon efficient. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about the exoplanets in the habitable zones in terms of water and Earth-like kinds of things?
Well, the exoplanets that I spoke about this evening, I didn't talk about any that were in the habitable zones. I'm trying to think, you know, we do have some planets that have been discovered that are in the habitable zone, which is basically, as I think you probably know, it's where liquid water could exist on the surface of a planet. Even though liquid water could exist on the surface of a planet, if it's in, you know, the top proper region so that its temperature could have liquid water there. We haven't detected a habitable planet yet, or don't have signs of a habitable planet yet. We haven't detected molecules in an atmosphere that indicate life, but we have detected examples of planets that orbit at the proper distance from their star that they could have liquid water, and they appear to be the size of a planet that we would expect to have water on. So there's more work to be done to actually just detect, though, molecules that would indicate that something's habitable versus in the habitable zone.
Am I right in thinking that it's easier to detect the larger Jupiter and Saturn kind of planets?
That's correct. It is, and it has to do well, especially with the transit technique, because we're actually measuring the light from the star. So the bigger the planet is, the more of the light from the star is blocked out. So if you have a given size star, it makes sense that it's easier to both detect the planet and detect the planet's atmosphere.
Of course.
If it's bigger. Yeah. And so that's why a lot of our initial detections of exoplanets were of the bigger ones. And then when we started to examine, I mean, the first exoplanet atmosphere that we detected was of a hot Jupiter as well, a Jupiter-sized exoplanet orbiting close to its host star. And so our first atmospheric detections were of those, and our more in-depth studies have been of the bigger planets. But now we're starting to get down to some of the smaller ones. And I think a lot of the focus on the smaller planets now is trying to determine if they really do maintain an atmosphere. You know, if you have a small planet that's orbiting a small host star, can it maintain an atmosphere?
Yeah.
So
good enough. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
But if we're interested in finding planets where there might be some kind of life, it seems that what you want not are the small stars, but more the G stars and ones that have maybe longer periods closer to the period that Earth has. But obviously there are fewer of those, and it's harder to get the information out of those stars and planets.
Right. I think, I don't know if you've heard of the Habitable Worlds Observatory, or also there were...
HABEX.
Yeah, or HABEX or LUVOIR were two studies. Yeah.
Yeah, those are coming, but I'll be alive when they get up.
Yeah, so the long-term goal is to do direct imaging of planets like those. Because one of the problems with the transit technique, if you want to observe the planet transiting its star, Earth is only going to transit the sun once a year So I think it's exciting to look towards that to the future. Hopefully you'll still be there when we see that.
Oh, I'm 85, so it's gonna
I see a pet on your lap.
I got two cats in front of me. They're expecting that at around 8 o'clock I give them a snack. They're waiting for their snack.
Poor things.
Excuse me, I'm not sure if I raised my hand. I'm still not sure if this is working.
I can't see hands.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Diana, and I have a question. I don't have an astronomy background. Like I said before, it's an AI, not astronomy.
Yeah.
But I'm curious. I know that there are different densities of stars depending on what phase they're in. At what point is a star too dense to host planets around it?
You're right. There's like stellar evolution, and this is interesting. So, you know, in stellar evolution, for example, after our sun dies, it will eventually become a white dwarf, very dense white dwarf. There have actually been planets observed orbiting white dwarfs, and there's a transiting exoplanet, and the planet, I'm sorry, I don't recall all the details to this paper right now, but I think it's a Jupiter-sized planet orbiting a white dwarf, and they're roughly similar in size, the white dwarf and the Jupiter-sized planet. So the planet partially transits the white dwarf but blocks some of its light. I mean, I would have to look up the paper to get the details, but even white dwarfs can host planets. Oh, yeah. And the first exoplanets discovered orbited a pulsar. And, there's a paper out there about that. You can look up the paper. I'm sorry, I don't recall all the details to that as well. But in terms of density, those are dense stars that host planets. Good question. I hadn't even been thinking about that recently.
And how far away would the planet have to be in order to not be sucked into a white dwarf?
It won't be sucked in, because the gravity is there, and as long as it's in a stable orbit, it can, you know, maintain an orbit around the star. There would have to be something causing its orbit to decay in order for it to go into the white dwarf. Or,
and wouldn't the gravity eventually cause that orbit to decay if it's strong?
Not necessarily. No.
Why not?
Because the angular momentum of the planet, the angular momentum of the planet will keep it in its orbit. I'm trying to think. I mean, it's kind of like the Earth is in a stable orbit around the sun. We're further away than, the white dwarf planet that I've heard about orbits on a closer orbit, but unless there's something to perturb the planet into changing its orbit, it's going to keep moving around that star. Yeah.
Wouldn't the perturbation for the planet be during the red giant phase of the star?
That could happen. Yeah, there have been studies done on planet engulfment and yeah, you're right. I mean, something could happen during the red dwarf phase, but once the red dwarf phase happens and then you have a white dwarf, if that planet is in a stable orbit, it's passed through the phase where it would be perturbed. So, yeah.
Wasn't there just a study something being swallowed, a planet being swallowed by a star, just in the last couple of weeks? Anyone seen that?
I don't recall that.
Yeah, there was. There was something about a planet being absorbed by a star. It was just in the news within the last week.
Do you know what the details, do you know the name of it or?
I don't remember.
I'd be curious. I'll have to look it up.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Okay, well, let me thank Dr. Louie for a wonderful talk, and let's all give her a round of applause for coming to us. We can do that silently. We can do that aloud.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Oh, I'll stop sharing now.
Yeah. A terrific talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you and have a good night. And we'll see everyone next month. We will have elections next month. And so we'll stop the recording. Oh.